This is UBC Arts on Air on CITR in Vancouver. I'm Brittany Dugan.
And I'm Rachel Sanders. Every other week, we feature the ideas and stories of students, faculty, and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. This evening on the program, we drop by SLACE. That's the School of Library, Archival, and Information Studies, also known as the iSchool.
We're Master of Journalism students here at UBC, and this year there's been a proposal to integrate the J School, our school, with the iSchool and the new Bachelor of Media Studies program. It would all be one big school.
There have been a lot of town hall meetings about this proposal over the last few weeks. People are wondering, how would these various schools actually mesh?
Mm-hmm. And we realize as journalism students that we don't actually know much about what goes on at SLACE. What are people studying, researching? What are their big questions? So we headed over to the Irving K. Barber Learning Center to find out.
Okay, walking into the iSchool at UBC. Rachel.
Our first stop at SLACE was the office of the acting director.
Yes, my name is Luanne Freund, and I'm acting director of the School of Library Archival Information Studies. We call ourselves the iSchool, the Information School.
What is the role of librarians in society today?
Well, there are all sorts of stories about libraries going away and books going away. And of course, we keep seeing those stories circle back on themselves. And libraries are in a period of resurgence now, as are print books. And so librarians, I think, one of their primary goals and their basic principles is access to information. And that doesn't necessarily mean books. It can mean many different things. And so librarians are champions of information access, of intellectual freedom. And they're also, one of the important roles that librarians have is this instructional role. We know that there is a digital divide in society. There are those who have the skills necessary to, for example, use the internet to perform all of their responsibilities as citizens, to file your taxes, etc. But there are many citizens who either don't have access to the technology or don't have the skills. Librarians can step into that gap in an instructional role and a supportive role, and we see that happening in public libraries, for example. There's a role in literacy as well, and certainly in work with children, new immigrants, all sorts of populations who have a need of both the information sources that are provided in libraries, but also the staff that are able to support them in using those materials.
So it's almost they are helping with the democratization of information, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that librarians, in a way similar to journalists, believe very much and devote their professional lives to this idea that the citizens need access to knowledge. They need to be aware of what's going on in society in order to be effective citizens, in order to be productive and lead productive lives.
Well, what role do librarians play when increasingly the information that we access is digital?
Yes, well, and that's really what we would like to see, is a shift to the focus on the information professional, even broader than librarian, because there's so many jobs in companies and in other kinds of organizations that require an understanding of how information is produced, how it's disseminated and shared, and how to make it more accessible. The majority of our graduates are librarians. However, our school has five different programs, one of which is a Master of Archival Studies. Most of the graduates go on to be archivists or records managers. We have a Master of Arts in Children's Literature program, where graduates may be authors of children's books or publishers. And so I use information professional because it's a better way to describe the variety of things that people do when they graduate from our programs.
What is the role of the physical building that houses a library in today's society?
Well, we do see a shift both in academic libraries and in public libraries to use that space as a place for people to come together. Information has become more social, and libraries have also they've always been places for people to come together, but this is emphasized in the way that new libraries are designed, for example, with you know, beautiful public architecture where people just want to be and spend time together and spend time with information. So I think that that's a part of it. One of the challenges is when so much information is moved online and people are accessing services, even public library services, certainly academic library services, they're accessing them through their devices and through the internet. They fail to see all of the work that goes on behind making that possible. And that's also one of the ways in which librarians, more than libraries of physical buildings, contribute to keep that whole infrastructure up and running and available to people.
Curation-wise or infrastructure-wise, how do you mean?
Well, for example, if you're accessing a book through the UBC library, there's all sorts of protocols and software and hardware behind the scenes that, you know, collects those materials, makes it easy for you to click through to the article that you're looking for. Collection is part of that, but I would say more it's about making all the pieces work together, talk together, describing the content in a way that it's findable, indexing it to make it findable, all of those things.
What do you wish everyone at UBC understood about the iSchool?
The iSchool is a place where a lot of new things are happening, a lot of innovation is happening, and so for many years people refer to us as the library school. We are a library school, but we're a lot more than that as well. And so some of our students go on to work, for example, in web design. Other students go into policy settings. Our graduates are out in many, many different areas. So, you know, we have courses in data science, data visualization. We have courses in, you know, Python programming. We have courses in community libraries. So it's really an exciting place. We try to introduce new technologies as they emerge, and our students have the opportunity to be exposed to that.
What do you imagine the next big hurdle is for the school and for information professionals?
The next big hurdle? I don't think of it as a hurdle. I think that we're a field that has been exposed to and faced with constant change for the past many decades, because we're a field that is very much connected to technology and the changes in technology. And so we're constantly evolving, we're constantly moving forward. I think that there are opportunities because the skills that are learned in becoming a librarian or an archivist are very, very valuable, transferable skills. And so the challenge we've always had is that we're not very well known or understood outside of our field. And so it's really about marketing. It's about making connections that we haven't made before and making sure that the employers that would love to have our students work for them know about us.
That's great. Thank you. That was Luann Freund, Acting Director of SLACE. So Luann gave us a great overview of the school.
But we still wanted to know what kind of research happens here.
Jennifer Douglas is an assistant professor at SLACE in the Master of Archival Studies program. Very broadly, what is the role of an archivist?
The role of the archivist is really to preserve authentic records so that they can be accessed and referenced forever, really. So what the archivist wants to do is to identify records that have long-term value for society, for reasons of evidence and accountability, and also for memory and culture and history, and then preserve them in their original context so that they can be understood in their original context over the long term.
Okay. How has that role changed in the digital age?
Well, the type of media, digital media really changes preservation needs of records. So where in the past, you know, you could rely a little bit on benign neglect and you could leave a box of paper for, you know, 25 years and come back and look at it and it would still be a box of paper. You can't really do that with digital records. So I think the primary change with digital records has been the need to be involved from the very beginning stages of creation. And to work with records creators to make sure that the records they're creating are going to be able to be preserved over the long term. So I think the digital preservation issue is a really big one. Also the volume of records that are being produced and the types of records that are created in sort of networked spaces. Those also pose different types of problems and concerns for archivists.
When most people think of archives, I think they maybe their minds go immediately to government or corporate archives, but one of your areas of research is personal archives. Can you explain what personal archives are?
Personal archives are archives that are created by individuals or families in their own kind of private lives, and there are also community archives, so that's been a really growing area of interest for archivists is how particular communities create and keep records. And a lot of, I think, the type of work that people do with records, with personal records, with community records, has to do with issues of identity and telling your own story, with memory, with sort of the more personal, really, this personal aspects of records. So a lot of my past research was on writers' archives, and the types of things you might find are things that are actually related to the writer's professional life, like drafts of manuscripts, correspondence with publishers, promotional material for book launches, that type of thing. But then also you'll find photographs, correspondence, diaries, notebooks, sometimes objects sneak in there, and So basically kind of anything that a person keeps as part of their archive is a personal archive.
And this sort of thing really makes up sort of the fabric of our culture, right? Personal individuals, the material that they collect over a lifetime.
Yeah, and people are finding really interesting ways to use personal archives. So one really fascinating use, I think, of personal archives lately has been climate scientists are looking at old pioneer diaries and sort of farmers' records to see what were the weather patterns in particular areas and tracing these weather patterns over time through private records, through just sort of, you know, a farmer's wife keeping a journal and writing at the beginning of every day, like sunny, cloudy, lots of rain, that kind of thing. So they kind of have this cultural role, but they also can be used in a lot of ways that you would never think, you know, as the creator of those records, you might never think of that sort of later use of them.
And one of the essays or one of the pieces of yours that I read argues that there should be greater study, that you think that there should be more attention given to the study of personal archives. Why is that?
Well, I think that one thing that I've discovered from teaching personal archives, and I've for a couple of years I've taught a course on personal archives, and I had students look at their own records and think about what records they created and their relationship to those records. And one of the assignments that I gave them was to kind of identify what constituted their personal archive and then think about how they would appraise that, so decide what was archival in nature, and then how they would represent that through what archivists call arrangement and description, which is really how we sort of make material available through a finding aid. And one of the things I discovered in doing that was that it was a really good way of helping students to see the personal relationships that there are in archives and that there are between archives and their creators, and the connection that people have to their records. So there's a kind of ethical dimension of how do we represent those creators through time. We're preserving their records, you know, sort of for eternity. So what are our responsibilities towards those people? And when the students had to work with their own records, they realized how vulnerable it could be to have your records in an institution and to sort of open your life up to that kind of scrutiny and, you know, the potential for people to be going over scraps of paper and really thinking about what did this person mean when they did that. So I think some of the reason why I'd like to see more emphasis on personal archives, especially in archival education, is because I think it helps us understand some of that ethical dimension and relationship to records.
What do you wish everyone on campus understood about archival studies?
I think that it's not just kind of a fusty, musty, old sort of endeavor. Archival repositories tend to be like in basements on campus, and ours is in, you know, Rare Books and Special Collections, and UBC archives are on the bottom floor of Barber, but they do have windows and they're kind of bright spaces, so that's good. But you know, sort of that archives are not hidden away, they're not old and boring and dusty. They're definitely not dusty. That they can be, you know, you're creating archives all the time. They're part of everybody's life. If you keep stuff, you know, if you keep a box of stuff under your bed or a bunch of files on your laptop, you are making your own archive all the time, right? So I think that to kind of understand that records and record keeping are integrated into our lives and that they participate in our lives in different ways. So one of the projects that I've been working on lately is how people use records and archives as part of a grieving process. And I think there's so many different things we do in our lives that records and archives are implicated in.
Makes me think of boxes of old letters from ex-boyfriends and that kind of memorabilia. You don't necessarily want all that stuff to survive past the end of your own life, do you?
Yeah, some stuff you have to let go of, right? And I think, like, as an archivist, I have kind of a funny perspective on that because I have a box in a closet full of journals, and everybody, I've told lots of different people, when I die, burn it. Don't open it, don't read it, burn it. So I want to keep it, and I want to read it all again someday, but it's really personal for me, and I'm not interested in... I think if my mother opened that box and read through there, if this were to happen sort of shortly after I died, say, she would find out all sorts of things about me that she never knew. And I think that could be a really kind of traumatic experience too, right? So I sort of have this very anti-archival impulse in my own life.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I feel exactly the same way about some of my old archives, and I don't want to get rid of them now, but I wouldn't want them to live beyond me, maybe. Yeah. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you. That was fun.
That was Jennifer Douglas, assistant professor in the Master of Archival Studies program. So interesting to hear about new directions for archival studies.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the archival branch of SLACE, but what about those last two letters in the name, Information Studies? What's that about?
To find out, we met up with Professor Mohammed Abdul-Majid.
Hi, my name is Mohammed Abdul-Majid, and I'm an assistant professor here in the School of Library, Archives, and Information Studies, for short, iSchool or SLACE. And my work is at the intersection of three areas: natural language processing, social media mining, and applied deep learning.
Let's break that down. What is natural language processing?
Yeah, natural language processing is basically about teaching machines how to understand and generate human language. So there are two legs to it. You know, you have a machine, you want this machine to be able to understand you when you talk to it. Think about maybe Siri, for example. So you say something, you ask a specific question, and you know, the machine is able to, you know, grasp what you said, but also you expect the machine to respond back. So that's a specific example of natural language processing. In this case, it's speech recognition.
Can you define for us social media mining?
Right. Social media mining is all about, and it's an emerging field, by the way, but it's all about people and data. So we say social media, so it's about people, the data that people generate on social platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and so on and so forth. And the idea is, you know, there is a lot of information buried within these types of social data. And if we wanted to learn more about people, different types of communities and individuals and so on, this data has a lot of treasures in it. And if we can possibly dig into these data and find different types of information, maybe we can use this information back to help communities and to help people and so on. So social media mining is all about using computational methods from a field like natural language processing or machine learning to learn about people from their own social data.
And your third area, was it machine learning? What's your third area?
Yeah, so I said the applied deep learning, and the deep learning in general, it's a branch of AI, artificial intelligence, and artificial intelligence as a field, you know, historically it has had its own, you know, ups and downs and so on. But machine learning is about creating machines that can do things automatically. So, you know, speech recognition, for example, or sentiment analysis, or, you know, all these types of natural language processing, they are instances of what machine learning is. But the field of machine learning is about, you know, the methods that you use in order to build these specific types of machines. And when we say applied deep learning, so deep learning is a specific example of machine learning. More specifically, it's a way where we mimic the information processing in the brain to build the machine. So human beings, you know, we think we have a way to understand the world and so on and interact with it. And, you know, how does this happen? When we use our brains, we have neurons communicating different types of information and so on. And the idea is that, can we build artificial brains? You know, deep learning is also called artificial neural networks, deep artificial neural networks. So it's about building artificial neurons in various levels. And, you know, the idea of deep comes from, you know, us being able to build, you know, layers of these neurons communicating in very intricate ways with each other.
The human brain has, I think, you know more than I do, a max capacity of how much we can learn and how fast we can process information. Computers are getting better and better every day. When do we become obsolete?
I don't think we will become obsolete at all. Simply because we believe in our human capacity. We are the people who build these systems. So we can build, you know, quote unquote, intelligent machines, but these machines eventually are not sentient. They are not capable of, you know, deciding on their own. Although, you know, it gets a little bit tricky. There are certain types of, you know, machine learning that people are working with right now, more specifically reinforcement learning, which tries to actually get around that problem of, you know, put this tool out there, let it interact with its environment, and it will adapt its behavior based on, you know, what happens and so on. But you know, humans are humans, they are intelligent, they are creative, they like art, you know, they are social, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, we're trying to build the machines, and we're being, you know, increasingly capable of doing that just as a function of us having lots of data right now. So we can actually use a lot of data in order to build these machines. You can imagine for a baby, in order to learn a language, the baby gets exposed to a lot of, you know, situations and learn from these situations. So, okay, now I can harvest, you know, all the social web and just give it to the machine. It will probably be a lot more than what a baby or what an adult human being will get exposed to in their lifetime. So, you know, machine learning has that advantage. But still, can we build social machines? Can we build sentient machines? And so on. And this is one of the questions I find very intriguing. And I kind of, you know, it keeps me like thinking, can I build social machines?
Right. What is the human connection between all your fields of study? Like, what is it that most inspires you that as a human that drives your work?
When you use machine learning in natural language processing to build all these tools, the overall goal is to improve our lives, to build tools that improve our well-being, to make us happier, to make us more connected, to make us relate to one another in more empathetic ways. And so for me, am I able at all to create a machine that understands people's emotions, and then maybe by going back and trying to interact with these people in a specific way that will make them feel good. You know, maybe if I do that, I have contributed to, you know, the well-being, the overall well-being of individuals and also communities. Another example, you know, if there is, you know, one sector of society that gets exposed to, you know, due to their job and their responsibilities, maybe they have burnout and they are stressed more than others. Am I able to detect when this happens? And maybe if I am, you know, using these tools, there could be some sort of intervention by possibly training these people how to be more resilient, how to communicate, you know, their empathy in ways that wouldn't necessarily hurt their health and well-being and so on. So that drives me.
Do you collaborate with people outside of academia? Like, how does your research then get pushed out into the world?
That's a great question. I get inspired by going out. So sometimes, you know, when I have some time, I would go to an art gallery, and I would literally go and talk to the artists and see how they, you know, represent reality and why did it come out this specific way and so on. And that kind of inspires me back in whatever I'm doing, right? Another example, you know, you'd have a friend who is a doctor, for example, and you chat with them and you know how they feel given a specific situation. Or maybe we can give the example of professors and, you know, how much they are expected to do, and, you know, that could, or maybe graduate students, you know, which, you know, you are examples of, and, you know, the responsibilities they have and so on. And then, you know, maybe given these relationships we have and this knowledge, you know, it would inspire me back to kind of try to put the technology in their service somehow.
Absolutely. So you're new to the iSchool. How are you finding it?
I like it. The iSchool is it's a very dynamic environment. We come from very varied backgrounds. And which is amazing, because eventually that's what inspires creativity. Also, our students are a mixture of students who come from the social sciences and so on in the humanities, but we also have students who are technologically savvy and you know, increasingly so on and so on. And then that mixture, you know, that salad, if you would, you know, is something that curates and nurtures creativity. And this is why I chose to work at the intersection of, you know, a number of areas that keep me happy somehow, because eventually it's all about, you know, doing what you love to do and you know, helping other people with these skills.
Well, it's been great to meet you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. And I'm happy to get to know you and the efforts you are doing. It's great, and keep it going.
That was Professor Mohammed Abdul-Majid. He's an assistant professor of information and media in the School of Library, Archival, and Information Studies.
And that concludes our tour of SLACE. If you missed some of today's episode, you can visit our website at artsonair.com, where we'll be posting the podcast this week.
You've been listening to UBC Arts on Air on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can get in touch with us via email at artsonair.info@gmail.com.
Or you can follow us on Twitter at artsonair. Thanks for listening.
See you next time.